Harbor for the first time. I'd like to thank Gordon and Costa for inviting me here. Nice to have a chance to meet some of you and see the place here. So, am I clear? Today I'm going to talk about tachyon condensation and string field theory. Is there a pointer or anything?
Right there.
Great. So this is a subject which has been quite busily studied over the last year or so, largely as a result of a few conjectures that Ashok Sen made a little over a year ago. Before I start in, let me say a few general things about why I think, even beyond Sen's conjectures, this is a good time to be looking back at string field theory. So, in the last 5 years or so, we've seen this huge second superstring revolution in which many remarkable new developments have occurred in string theory, including the recognition of duality symmetries relating all the different superstring theories, and the presence of D-brains, as shown by Joel Polchinski, which have become really fundamental building blocks for a lot of things in the theory. And using those two tools, we've learned that there are several particular ways that we can describe the physics of M-theory or string theory in very specific backgrounds. There's the matrix theory conjecture, which connects M-theory in a flat background with matrix quantum mechanics, and there are the ADS-CFT conjectures, which connect string theory in various ADS cross-spherical geometries to super-Yang-Mills and other conformal field theories. So these are really extremely interesting developments, but they essentially end up with giving us various descriptions of string theory and M-theory in fixed backgrounds. And, of course, for certain kinds of questions, we really would like to be able to go beyond that and talk about the space of possible backgrounds for string theory and address questions like vacuum selection and cosmological issues. So there is this formalism of string field theory, which was developed before this recent revolution, which in some senses promises to be able to give us a background-independent description of string theory. And until recently, until about a year ago, this seemed like a very baroque and complicated formalism, and it was really difficult to see whether there were any simple and concrete things that one could say about it. And I think what has come to light following the conjectures of Ashok Sen a year ago is that this is really a formalism we can work with and do some calculations and do some abstract theory and really figure some interesting things out about. So that's what I'm going to talk about today. Some particular questions we can ask using string field theory and what string field theory has to say about those things. The work I'll be talking about today that I was involved with was partly work with Ian Elwood and Nicholas Muller, who are two graduate students at MIT. So let me start by sort of introducing the problem that we're going to try to address here, which is related really to the simplest string theory that we know about, that's consistent string theory, and that is the open string with purely Neumann boundary conditions in 26 dimensions. We've got just an open bit of bosonic string fluctuating around, and we can look at the spectrum of excitations of that string, and associated with each state in the string Fock space, there is a space-time field. So the ground state of the string Fock space is associated with a space-time field phi, which is tachyonic. It has a negative mass squared. So here I've just chosen units where this is normalized to -1. Really, there's a 1 over alpha prime in there. If we act with raising operators for the various bosonic modes on this ground state, we get excited states which correspond to more massive fields in space-time. So, for instance, this set of states corresponds to components of a gauge field, a massless gauge field living in space-time. We can use more raising operators, and we build spin 2 and higher spin massive fields living in space-time. And there's a problem with this theory, which was recognized very early on in the development of string theory, and that is that the theory looks unstable. That's because the first field here is tachyonic. So if we start out in the perturbative vacuum, this vacuum is unstable and is inclined to roll off into some other unknown physics. And from the early days of string theory, it was thought that this was really a fundamental problem with this formalism, with this particular kind of string theory. Now, early on, there were some suggestions that there might be some more stable vacuum that this theory could decay into. So there was some work by Bardacci and Halpern, which sort of hinted at this, and then some very concrete work by Kostolesky and Samuel, where they did some precise calculations and showed that maybe there really is a vacuum in there. But nobody really knew how to interpret that. And until the recent proposal of sin, there was really no one really took this very seriously. So in this talk, I'm going to discuss the solution to this tachyon problem, following the picture which was suggested by Sen a year ago. And as I was saying, I think that this is interesting for a number of reasons. First of all, it addresses the question of the tachyon and the bosonic string, but also it ties into some very important and fundamental questions in string theory. Questions like how to describe non-perturbative string physics, how to do background-independent string calculations and to start to address questions of vacuum selection, and finally, how to understand the symmetries of string theory. String theory has a very large and rich symmetry structure, which we really don't understand very well at this point in time. So, let me get into the formalism a little bit. The tool I want to use to address this is Witten's cubic open bosonic string field theory. There's another approach called background independent or boundary string field theory, which has been used in recent years to make some progress, and I'll mention that briefly as I go, but mostly I'm going to focus on this cubic version of the string field theory. So what is string field theory? String field theory is an off-shell description of the interactions between strings, which describes an infinite series of fields, the fields which are associated with the various states in the string Fock space. So we can formally write a string field, which is an expansion where we have fields multiplying states in the string Fock space. Again, there's an infinite number of terms in this expansion. And what we want to do is write an action in terms of this string field. So Witten, quite some time ago, proposed a very elegant and simple action, which takes the form of a Chern-Simons action, a cubic action for the bosonic string field theory. So the action looks like this. Phi is the string field. Q is the BRST operator of the string theory. I'll say a little bit more concrete things about that in a moment. Let me just give you a general picture here. The star here is a star product, which is essentially the operation of taking two strings, cutting each evenly in half, and gluing the left half of one string to the right half of the other string with a delta function interaction. That means that the interaction vertex consists of taking three strings and gluing them all together like this. So in the conformal field theory language, this interaction vertex looks like this. So this is a very simple form for the action, although the physics it describes is very complicated, and of course, because there are an infinite number of fields, this is a pretty complicated thing. At least it looks simple in some sense. This action, just like a Chern-Simons action, is invariant under stringy gauge transformations. So the physical field here should be associated with states of ghost number one. There are ghosts and anti-ghosts which come into the system, which I'll mention more later. The gauge transformation parameters are ghost number zero string fields, and the change in phi is given by Q times the parameter lambda, which is a zero, ghost number zero string field, plus the string coupling G, phi star lambda minus lambda star phi. So if you plug this in, you see that this action is invariant under this set of gauge transformations. Now, in order to actually calculate things in this theory, we want to be a little more concrete. And a very nice Fock-based representation of this entire theory has been worked out. Q, of course, is the standard BRST operator. We take anti-ghost raising operators multiplying matter and ghost Virzoro generators. The interaction vertex can be described in two different ways. One is using the language of conformal field theory, along the lines of the picture I showed in the previous transparency. Another more algebraic way to describe the interaction vertex is to write it as some object V which acts on the tensor product of three string Fock spaces. And an explicit Fock space representation for this operator V was written down by Gross and Yavitsky and also by Samuel and others in varying forms. The explicit form of the vertex operator looks like this. We have a delta function over the sum of the momenta. We have the three ground states with various ghost C0 operators. And then we just have a quadratic form in the ghost, anti-ghost, and matter raising operators. These coefficients here are just numbers. And they can be calculated using some recursive formulae, which I won't bother to give here, but they're just numbers which one can calculate. So this, in principle, gives a completely well-defined calculational framework in which to actually ask questions and do calculations in string field theory. So what I'm going to describe in this talk is the results of doing a bunch of these calculations to address certain questions.
The integral on the left-hand side is which outer space, which space?
Good. Okay. That's there's two ways to think about this. Probably, I wrote the integral mostly because that form makes it look a little more like a Chern-Simons interaction. A better way to think about it, perhaps, is to take the state on the left and to take the BPZ dual of it and hit it into the other two states. So there's another way of thinking about it where you write integral of A star B is equal to AB, where this is a certain naturally defined dual state to that state. Good. Okay, so that's the calculational framework. Now, what are the questions that we want to address? Well, as I told you, we have this negative mass squared tachyon. And Sen has this conjecture about what should happen to describe that tachyon. So Sen's picture of the tachyon in open bosonic string theory is as follows. We have an unstable vacuum. He suggests that this is naturally associated with the presence of a D25 brain, that is a space-filling brain, which acts as a place where open strings can end in the perturbative vacuum. And he suggests that the decay of this tachyon corresponds to the decay of this D-brain, leaving us with empty space where before we had some space-filling brain. So a consequence of this conjecture, or there are several consequences, and these are enumerated here. One is a very concrete statement. It is that the difference in energy between the unstable vacuum and some stable vacuum, which can be reached after tachyon condensation, is given by delta E is the volume of space-time times the tension of the 25 brain. Another statement which he suggested is that lower dimensional brains should be realized as solitons of the string field in doing this decay, so that there should be lower dimensional D brains, which one can see as states in this lower vacuum. And finally, if this picture is correct, it suggests that at the bottom of the hill, we should see a very different vacuum. We should really see the closed string vacuum. And that in particular, all the open string fields which live at the top of the hill should decouple from the theory. Well, there's a little bit of disagreement at this point as to exactly what that vacuum is. We might hope that it's the perturbative closed string vacuum. And then the question is, will we see the closed strings starting from the open string field theory? And there is not yet a conclusive answer to that question. I mean, we know that closed strings appear in intermediate channels when we do open string scattering. But we don't really know that. I mean, it's a rather tall order to suggest that when we get to the bottom of the hill, the new theory that we get there will really be a closed string field theory. But it's possible that that's the case.
For instance, would you see a closed string tachyon?
I'll discuss the issue of what we see in terms of a perturbative spectrum when we get to the bottom of the hill. That's one of the questions I'm going to address in the talk today. Whether you see the closed string tachyon is an open question. One would have to go to some probably quantum formalism to be able to address that question. We don't know how to do that yet. So the main parts of this which I'm going to address in the talk today are the basic fact of decaying of the vacuum and going down to a new vacuum with delta E is given by this formula, and the question of the open string fields decoupling at the new vacuum. I think Emil Martinick will discuss some aspects of this question of lower dimensional brains appearing as solitons, so I won't really mention that today, but he'll give some nice picture of that part of the story. As Kostas was just asking, this part of the question really has not yet been satisfactorily addressed, so I won't have much to say about it.
What happens to the left side?
It's a good question. It's a good question what happens to the left side. I'll actually come back to that in a moment or two. Okay. Let me see here. Okay, so now what we would like to do is take this calculational framework of string field theory that I described and really do some calculations and see how accurately we can reproduce this picture. Let me just mention, I guess I didn't put it on a transparency, but just to be clear about this. If we just take the tachyon field phi, the part of the action describing the tachyon field phi is just minus 1/2 phi squared plus kappa g phi cubed, where kappa is just some numerical constant. So if we just look at the tachyon field and we forget about all the other fields, the potential really does look like this. So the question is, what happens when we look at the full string field theory? So in order to address this kind of question, we need to take this formalism where we have an infinite number of fields, and we need to drop all but a finite number of fields so we can actually do calculations. So there's a systematic procedure for doing this called level truncation, which basically just means we drop all the string fields associated with states above a certain level in the Fock space. So we just throw out a bunch of stuff, and we look at a finite number of fields, and we do calculations for those fields. So level truncation, I'll refer to it as level truncation Li, where L is the maximum level of fields which we keep, and I is the maximum level of interactions which we keep. So there are, of course, three strings interacting. So generally, we would have L3L as the truncation level, but we'll find that that's not always the most computationally effective way of doing things. So the motivation for this is that it's been found in a variety of contexts, in particular in this string field theory context, that if you saturate intermediate states in various calculations with low-lying fields, you often get a very accurate systematic approximation scheme to various things. Now, I would say that nobody completely understands yet why exactly this is a good approximation scheme, but it definitely seems to work for a lot of things. So an example of what it works well for is the off-shell tachyon four-point function, let's say evaluated at zero momentum. So the Feynman diagrams for this would look something like this. We have two phi phi psi vertices where psi is some scalar string field. And we want to basically sum over all possible fields psi I. Well, it was shown by Kostolesky and Samuel that if we just take the two level two scalar fields, which appear at level two, we already get 72% of the exact value for this. So the exact value had been calculated by Samuel, also using string field theory, and this was basically a check to see how well this level truncation worked. So Nick Muller and I did a similar calculation, including 7,000 fields up to level 20, and found that by that time you get 96% of the correct answer. The convergence is fairly quick, but not extraordinarily quick. So anyway, this seems like a good approximation scheme. Before all this recent work, many years ago, Kostolesky and Samuel had used this approximation scheme to try to understand whether there was another more stable vacuum that this theory would decay into. And in fact, they found indications that there is a more stable, a fairly stable vacuum, stable both in the sense of an instability due to the absence of tachyon, the lack of instability from tachyons, also stable in the sense that as we increase the level of truncation, it seems to stay there. So they found this vacuum, but nobody knew what to make of it. After Sen's conjecture, Sen and Zwieback did a very nice calculation where they compared this vacuum, which they computed in a different way, with the energy expected by Sen's conjecture, and they found that already 98.6% of the desired amount of energy was reproduced by this simple level truncation. So this level truncation involves 10 scalar fields. Okay, so we wanted to address a number of questions related to this theory, and over the last year, in collaboration with my students, we've written a number of programs which automate the symbolic manipulation needed to calculate all the vertices in this string field theory. The goals of doing this are to explore the cubic string field theory, verify Sen's conjectures, study the vacuum and the behavior of the theory around the vacuum, and part of my motivation has been to look at enough data that we can hope to make some guesses about the analytic structure of the theory. I mean, we really want to find an analytic solution. It's very hard to solve this theory analytically. And basically, over the last year, I've been going back and forth between trying to do something analytic and getting horribly stuck, and then going back and doing another complicated calculation. And I keep hoping that next time the analytic stuff will just work and I can stop doing calculations. But so far it hasn't. But there are some promising things en route. Anyway, mostly what I'm going to describe today is a lot of these calculations using this automated procedure for calculating the string field theory. So an example is, if we take just the action for zero momentum scalars, so we want to look at the vacuum, which is going to be a Lorentz invariant vacuum and translation invariant in particular, so we can drop all momentum dependence, which simplifies the story quite a bit. And we can just look at scalars, because this is, again, going to preserve Lorentz invariance, so we don't need to consider vector and higher tensor fields. So then we have a very simple action, a simple in form, which is basically a cubic polynomial in the infinite set of scalar string fields. So we can write it in this form. Dij control the quadratic terms, Tijk control the cubic terms, G is the string coupling. So in a given level truncation, we do a complicated calculation, and what we end up with are the coefficients in this cubic action. So here are some calculations we've done. The first one refers to this kind of action right here. We've calculated the full action for zero momentum scalars in a particular gauge called Feynman-Siegel gauge, which is the gauge that everyone else has worked in up to this point. Kostolevsky and Samuel and Sen and Zwieback worked in this gauge also. Up to level 1020, so that's level 10 fields, level 20 interactions. There's about 250 fields, about 100,000 interactions. Each one is a rational number which has, you know, a numerator is a very large product of primes, the denominator is 3 to a very large power in general. So we've done this calculation. We've generalized this in a number of ways. We've calculated the gauge-independent action, so keeping all the fields without doing gauge fixing, up to level 1020. That involves 430 fields and about 600,000 interactions. We've calculated a bunch of terms with momentum dependence. These are terms where we take one scalar field, multiply by another scalar field at minus p and another scalar field at plus p, up to level 612. This is fewer fields. It's 160 fields. Here we have to include longitudinal polarizations of all the tensor fields, so we actually get a lot more fields. And we get about 50,000 interaction terms, but these are much more complicated because now they're complicated polynomials and actually transcendental functions of P. The reason that these are important is because these give us the quadratic momentum-dependent terms in the action in the new vacuum. And those are what we need to understand the structure of excitations around the new vacuum. So in addition to calculating these actions, we've done calculations of the gauge transformations, partly as a check and partly to understand aspects of the structure. We calculated the zero momentum gauge transformations up to level 816 and the momentum dependent gauge transformations to level 612. Unfortunately, this truncation process breaks gauge invariance. So we can only check the gauge invariance to order g to the 1. It preserves gauge invariance to order g to the 1, but breaks it at order g squared. So we've checked gauge invariance.
Okay, so how do you consider momentum dependent part, which is important for the property of kinetic time, as you discussed?
Yes.
So do you keep also tensor fields?
We keep longitudinal polarizations of tensor fields. Oh. So what we've computed so far for I'll come back to this when I talk about the spectrum calculations. What we've really computed so far involves the quadratic momentum dependent terms for even level scalars. So there are many fields which we have not yet really considered in this same framework. We're really considering a subset of all fields. So if you remind me when I come back to the statement I make about the spectrum, it should be taken with the caveat that we've only done this calculation for even level scalars.
Okay. For scalar kinetic time, that kind of computation is sufficient to.
That's right. So we do include, for instance, for a spin 2 tensor field like B mu nu, we include longitudinal polarizations of the form P mu, P nu, B mu nu of P. Right, that's essentially a scalar field which mixes with all the other fields.
I see. I have another question.
Yes, please.
I asked this question earlier, so I don't expect. But I have another question. In this kind of program, you don't have apparent small parameters.
Correct.
To do the
question. Correct.
Maybe there is some kind of some hidden small parameter. And one thing that might be interesting is that how all these budget works, namely that you're going to have larger number of fields as you increase the level.
Yes.
And that presumably all these fields become increasing exponentially small as you increase the level.
That's basically
correct.
And so there
has to be some kind of compensation. And do you see some kind of pattern of how this goes?
Yeah. I mean, roughly speaking, the interaction
between a field of level L1, a field of level L2, and a field of level L3 goes something like kappa to the L1 plus L2 plus L3, where kappa is approximately 1/3.
Oh, okay, but
so there is some suppression.
The tachyon field is of order of square root of inverse of kappa.
The tachyon field is on the order of 1 over kappa g. Yeah.
Kappa g.
G factorizes out from everything, okay, so you don't have to worry about it. But kappa is important, yeah. And it is true that the expectation values of the fields also seem to decrease fairly rapidly. It's a little bit tricky because it's a little hard to say what you mean by what the expectation value of the field is because you need some normalization. For the normalization, you really need a positive definite inner product to sort of define that, and we don't actually have such a thing. You can make ad hoc, I will describe, in fact, ad hoc definitions of such a thing.
My question was also, you see the decrease
for certain things, there are non-trivial cancellations. So there are certain things you can try to look at where you get some exponential decay and then something else is exponentially growing. And that's actually
these things. The problem is it's a little hard to prove definitively that any of these things are. You get the asymptotes. Sorry, Emily, you have a.
Yeah. The exponent of the exponential growth of these states is? Because presumably, well, if you look at all string states at level L,
yes,
right, the growth is exponential with some exponent, which is, I don't know,
you mean the number of states?
Yeah, it's square root of 26, some pi's and so on.
Yes.
So,
you're looking for the
growth. But here you're looking at scalars, so
right.
The growth is presumably a little slower. But still, it's still going to be exponential.
It is exponential.
So
yeah.
The question is,
that's
it's a little bit misleading to say, oh, there's this big suppression.
Absolutely. That's why I'm saying for certain things, you can actually calculate the exponential growth of one thing and the exponential suppression of another, and you get an exact cancellation. So there was one calculation I was trying to do at one point, trying to show, for instance, that the spectrum is unshifted at high levels. And for that calculation, I carefully went through the asymptotics and found that there's a suppression, exponential suppression,
also an exponential growth. In that case, due to the e to the p squared factors that appear in the couplings, which then also has some kappas and things in it. And it turns out that those precisely cancel, so that an argument just based on the exponential suppression versus growth will not give you the answer to the question you're asking. You have to be more subtle and include, you know, polynomial factors. I haven't done that analysis. So for some things, you're absolutely right that that's key. This is a very glib answer to why things are suppressed. As I said at the beginning, I really don't understand why things are suppressed. It could be that if one is really careful and goes into the asymptotics, one could make some statements about it. But it is subtle because there's exponential growth killing off, in many cases, the exponential decay. And it's not quite obvious why things work.
Possibly another way to proceed would be the boundary effect of action
techniques.
Yep. Because there, it's everything's phrased in terms of renormalization group language.
Yep.
And if you knew what the map was between these fields and those fields, you could just say, okay, these are all coefficients of some irrelevant operators, which are going to be unimportant as you approach this bottom of the potential.
Yep, I think that's potentially a very promising way to go. In fact, when I was in Chicago, David and I were talking a bit about this. You might have talked to you about that a little bit.
No, no.
But we've talked about that a bit, and it looks like there's some things you could do. But there's things I get very confused about in the BSFT framework, which I still haven't worked out. So when you include massive fields, we can maybe have an offline discussion about that. But I'm just a little confused. But it's a very promising direction.
Eventually, we would like to understand both formalisms, and they will give us the same answer for everything, and it'll all be a beautiful picture, but we're not there yet. Okay.
Do you have any understanding for one set?
It basically just comes from the... I could be glib and say it's because there are three strings, but I don't know. Okay, so let me just tell you a bit about some of the results. Excuse me. So to find the stable vacuum, what do we have to do? We have to basically take this action I described and write the quadratic equations we get by varying each of the fields and solve those n quadratic equations. So we did that at various levels, and we find the following results. Here's a table at each level truncation of the expectation value of phi and the energy of the ground state normalized by this V here is actually the energy of the ground state divided by T25. Change what V means, sorry. Anyway, this would go to 1 if Sen's conjecture was correct. So we find that as the level truncation is increased, here we have the number that Kostolevsky and Samuel and Sen and Zwieback calculated, which is 98.6%. And as we go down to higher and higher level, by the time we get to 1020, we're 99.91% of the way down there. So this convergence is happening very quickly. And let me point out that this is happening faster than the convergence of the coefficients in the effective action, which I mentioned earlier. It's interesting. So in some sense, this is maybe converging even better than one might guess by some asymptotic methods. this error is down by about this factor of 1/3 at each level. I don't know how seriously to take that, but just note it. We also have computed the expectation values of all the fields in this vacuum, and we find that this is also converging very rapidly. So here we're probably within about 0.1% of the correct value of the vacuum, and that's going to be useful for what I want to talk about next. Now, one interesting complication appeared when we did this calculation. We calculated the effective potential for the tachyon by fixing the tachyon value and solving the other n-1 quadratic equations. And we found that at each level of truncation, there were branch points in the effective potential, basically corresponding to the fact that one of the quadratic equations you're trying to solve gets imaginary roots when you get to a certain point. And in fact, the places where those branch points appeared converged to very specific points along the tachyon potential. So what do these mean? Well, for the last, a year or so, I had all kinds of different speculations as to what this meant. In fact, you asked the question earlier of what happens if you go to the left. And I was sort of thinking that maybe this branch point off to the left meant that something special happened to the physics, so you didn't really keep going down infinitely. Now, from the point of view of boundary string field theory, this potential just seems to keep going down infinitely far. Because you can actually do exact calculations in boundary string field theory and you get the effective potential. It's very good for addressing this kind of question. So this seems to be some kind of an artifact. So we finally tracked this down a couple months ago when we figured out the answer. The answer is that these branch points arise because the gauge choice that we're making, Feynman-Siegel gauge, becomes a bad choice of gauge at those points. We hit the point in field space where we have basically a Gribov ambiguity. So we can't use this gauge beyond those points. Let me just tell you a little bit about how that works, because it's kind of interesting and is relevant to trying to do certain other calculations. Feynman-Siegel gauge basically sets a certain set of fields to zero. I'll call them fields indexed by Q. It sets fields to zero associated with scalars with a C0 in their definition. The formula for gauge variation is that if we write it in terms of the phis and gauge parameters mu, it looks much like the cubic action form. We have delta phi I is dIA times gauge parameter mu A, something which is just linear in the mu's, plus a term which is linear in the mu's and linear in the phis. Now, when does this gauge choice break down? This gauge choice breaks down when the gauge variation in a particular direction becomes essentially tangent to the slice chosen by the gauge, right? Because you want the gauge parameter to move you in a direction perpendicular to the gauge slice, or else you're in trouble. So at this point, that the gauge breaks down when the determinant of this thing becomes zero, where phi j angle brackets is the expectation value of phi. So this is, of course, an infinite dimensional matrix, but we can level truncate and ask the question, is this what happens to this determinant of the of the finite size matrix under level truncation? And what we find is that at least near the origin, the place where the determinant vanishes has a stable locus, which seems to be stable under level truncation in the sense that it doesn't move much more as we increase the level. Furthermore, we find that the branch points coincide with the place where the determinant vanishes. So that seems to settle the question. Let me just show you some pictures to convince you of this. So here are approximations to the boundary of the validity region of the Feynman-Siegel gauge projected into the phi B plane, where B is the trace of Bij. It's just one of the other scalar fields. So at level 2.6, we get this boundary. At level 4.12, we get this boundary, 6.18, 8.16, et cetera. So we see that these lines are getting closer and closer together, which makes us fairly optimistic that this is converging to a well-defined boundary. Now, here's a projection of the curve we follow when we look at the tachyon effective potential. It cuts out at a branch point here and here. Now, again, this is a projection from an infinite dimensional space down to two dimensions, so we don't expect this to hit the boundary of this region. Really, this boundary sort of slopes out. If we look in a third dimension, it sort of slopes out with a roof like this, and it turns out these things come up and just about hit the roof. But that's a little hard to describe in a two-dimensional picture, so let me draw a different picture, which is what happens to the determinant as we go along the tachyon potential. What we find is that at these two branch points, this determinant, which moves along smoothly, suddenly starts to plummet. And the numerics is difficult there, but it's basically heading towards zero very rapidly as we come to the point where we hit the branch points. Let me just show you some pictures which are kind of fun and give you some sense of what the space looks like where the Feynman-Siegel gauge is valid. So what is this? This is a graph of the sine of the determinant in a level 4.12 truncation. The perturbative vacuum is somewhere right around here. The non-perturbative vacuum is somewhere right around here. We have this big region in which the determinant is positive, which is black.
Is this 5B plane?
This is, again, the 5B plane. Yes, I'm sorry. I didn't even label that, did I? Sorry, that's bad. 5B plane, yeah. Everything here is just a slice in the 5B plane. We could do slices in different subplanes, and we get similar pictures, just to give you a sense. In the 5B plane, we have the two vacua here, and we have this big region where Feynman-Siegel gauge is valid. And then the important thing here is really is where the boundary between the regions are. This is where the sign of the determinant flips. And you can't cross one of the boundaries and stay in the same gauge. So that's in the 412 truncation. If we do a 618 truncation, we see that the region gets a little bit smaller, and we get some more structure out here. Again, the two vacua are something like there and there, very close to the boundary of the region. We can go up, and we get an 816 truncation. Again, we have a similar thing and more structure appearing outside. We can do this at a larger distance scale. So this is larger values of phi and b. At level 412, we see a similar structure, and now this stuff out here. At level 618, we see all kinds of structure developing at larger distances, which is not very stable under level truncation. But this oval sort of region here is the region where, containing the origin where the big gauge is valid. It seems to be fairly stable. In a higher level truncation, we see that it's almost pinched off from the rest of the thing. And we have all kinds of structure out there, which probably is not stable, but it indicates that as we keep raising the level truncation, staying in Feynman-Siegel gauge is just horribly difficult out here because there's all kinds of different places where it breaks down.
It's not stable because the derivative truncations are not good outside this oval region.
That's basically right. I mean, I suspect that if we went up to, you know, level truncation 100, 200 or something, we would actually probably be able to get a pretty good picture of the structure in a pretty large region. But it's the number of the density of these boundaries might increase and become infinite as we go to infinite level truncation. I really don't know. The point to take from this is that the gauge orbits under Feynman-Siegel gauge are really complicated. It's not just some nice little parabolic thing going through space. It's really some very complicated structure. So to understand the gauge symmetry of the theory, I think, is a very interesting challenge.
So I understand that you give an explanation of the why there is a branch point. But
yes. Good answer. Okay, so here's this picture. So it looks like the picture really is that this thing goes down to infinity. This is, you can see this from boundary string field theory, and if you try to look at other gauges, you can see that this thing sort of seems to continue going down. I don't know what the answer is to why the thing doesn't roll off in this direction. It's been speculated, I guess Emil can maybe say more about that, that if you go over to the left, that corresponds to the closed string tachyon, but I don't know whether you believe that, Emil.
I don't believe it.
Okay.
So in the boundary of our theory point of view, that corresponds to the time on the perturbation in the rolling sign?
Correct. Yeah. And I don't think anybody has a really compelling answer to that question. I mean, there are certain problems with the bosonic string. I've been taking the point of view that we want to do as much as we can in the bosonic string because it's much simpler to calculate things here than in the superstring. And there's a certain class of questions to which we can get nice answers both in the superstring case and in the bosonic string case, but it's technically much more practical to do it in the bosonic string theory. At a certain point, we might hit the point where bosonic string theory just isn't very good anymore, and we really have to move to the superstring. We haven't hit that point yet, but it may be that this is related to really fundamental problems with the bosonic string related to the instability of the closed bosonic string. I really don't know, but I don't have anything more to say about that.
But in spite of
string
problem,
yes.
This at another level, it looks like just an ordinary scalar theory. If you just put a phi cube, we know it is unstable.
That's right.
It looks like a phi cube potential.
It does.
So presumably that's because the extra phi 4 or phi to the 6 is not taken into account.
Well, the problem is that this is really supposed to be the full theory for the bosonic theory. So there's nothing.
No, but the effective action somehow should.
But the effective, okay, we have calculated, and that's, for instance, I mentioned we calculated the effective action at various higher levels. We really have calculated the terms in the quartic term, cubic, quintic, phi to the sixth term, etc. And when we do that calculation, when we calculate the effective action, that's when we don't yet have a condition that goes. goes past that branch point, because we don't know how to work out of that gauge. I'll just mention, we can try to calculate without fixing gauge, but there are other serious problems that emerge. So I don't know yet how, from cubic string field theory, to give a convincing picture that the effective action really does go down to infinity. But from this other point of view, boundary string field theory, it does look like it goes down infinitely far. Now, for a little while, this was one reason I was a little skeptical of bosonic string field theory, but I now will not complain about it for that reason, because I think cubic string field theory eventually will give us the same answer.
The boundary string field theory only does something like this. So it's supposedly a classical.
Yeah, basically the boundary string field theory decouples the tachyon from everything else.
Right.
So you can just write down the action for the tachyon and you're done. It's excellent for addressing certain questions. It's excellent for addressing the distance between the two vacua, because it gives exactly the right answer. And it's excellent for writing down a potential, because it gives a nice, well-defined potential. For the next thing which I'm going to describe, which is really understanding the physics of the vacuum here, it's not so good, because the entire action gets suppressed. In the boundary string field theory picture, you get a picture which looks like this. And as t goes to infinity, that corresponds to the point down here. So you don't actually have a good picture of what the physics in the vacuum is. One reason I like the cubic string field theory picture is that it allows us to do explicit computations in this vacuum to try to understand what the theory is. So, yeah, I don't know about this thing to the left. It's a very good question. We don't know the answer yet. Okay. How much longer do I have?
As much as you want.
Okay. I'm sorry, I won't go on for too long. I was trying to figure out if I started a little bit late. Okay. Now let's try to ask some questions about the physics in the stable vacuum. So if we put the vacuum to be some non-zero value of the string field, we write it like this, call it phi naught, we can shift the string field by writing phi as an expansion around phi naught, where phi tilde is the expansion parameter around phi naught. This gives us a new action, which is a constant plus essentially the same string field theory action we had before, where phi tilde appears in place of phi, and now we have a new BRST operator, q tilde, which is given by the old BRST operator q plus, and this really has an implicit star, commutator, phi naught star whatever it's acting on. So that's really a commutator of phi naught or anti-commutator, depending on what the ghost number of the thing it's acting on is. Anyway, we have a very similar action. The only difference is now the BRST operator is much more complicated because it encodes this star product with the vacuum. So this defines some new open string field theory. And the question is, what is that theory? So as I said a moment ago, in answer to someone's question, it might be that this is a new description of closed string field theory. I guess Costas was asking this. Where do we see the closed strings? It's totally unclear. But what we want to understand is, what is this theory? So the first thing we can try to do is understand the perturbative fluctuation spectrum of open strings around this new vacuum. So we can do that by looking at the quadratic term in the action, which we get by phi tilde q tilde phi tilde. So to do this, we need to understand the action of q tilde on a general string field. Now, according to Sen's conjecture, the open strings should completely decouple from the theory. So we shouldn't see any open string excitations, any physical open string excitations in this vacuum. So, can that really happen? So I'll give you an example. If we do a level 0,0 truncation, that means just keeping the tachyon, the quadratic term looks like this. We have phi minus p, phi p, p squared minus 1 over 2, that's just the usual quadratic term from q, and then we have this part coming from the expectation value of phi, g kappa times 16 over 27 to the p squared times 3 expectation value of phi. Now, if we plug in values of phi anywhere near the true vacuum, like 1 over 3 g kappa, for instance, which is what we get in the 0,0 truncation, we have this transcendental equation for p. And in fact, there are no real solutions, that is, for p squared being real, there are no solutions to having this thing here vanishing. That means that there are no physical states in this truncated theory, no physical perturbative states. So in this simple truncation, the physical states are removed because the poles are moved off into the complex plane.
How do you define the distance from the real axis? Namely, when you say it's not real, of course it should be you should be saying that no pole for approximately real is real.
I can address that. Let me go a little further and maybe address that question in a moment, because this is just a low-level truncation. It's some ways off the real axis, and what we're really interested in is what happens as we raise the level of truncation. Does anything approach the real axis or not? So Let me address your question maybe after I talk about the results of the general spectrum calculation, when I can make it a little more clear. Now let's go to level 2.6. Now there are 7 scalars. They look like this, various combinations of ghost and matter operators acting in a scalar fashion, all at level 2. Now we have a 7x7 matrix, each component of which looks roughly like this. And we want to ask, is there any value of P squared where we see a physical pole? So that would be a place where the determinant of this matrix would vanish. Now, we do see real poles in this matrix in the 7x7 level 2.6 truncation. So then we have to address the more subtle question, are these physical? So to be physical, we need to do this thing, which we do in regular string theory, which is to look at the cohomology of the system, where we look at the set of ghost number 1 string fields annihilated by Q1, which is acting on ghost number 1, and then we consider any two states which are closed, in the sense that Q1 acting on them is 0, to be equivalent if they differ by something which you get by acting with Q tilde 0 on a ghost level 0 string field. So this is basically looking at the set of closed states and considering all exact states to be physically trivial. So we've computed the spectrum using this technique up to level 6.12 and looked at whether the states are exact or not. So first, here's a picture of all the closed states. As I described, at level 0.0, there are no closed states, so we see no dots, nothing in the spectrum. At level 2.6, we do see some states corresponding to various vanishing points for that determinant. Level 4.12, we get lots of them. At level 6.12, we get even more. Various levels of m squared. This line here represents a cutoff. That's essentially the mass squared level associated with our level truncation. And if Sen's conjecture is correct, we would expect all the states below the cutoff to be exact.
When you say real solution, do these not include approximately real?
They do not include approximately real solutions. And I'll tell you why if you give me one more transparency.
Oh, sure.
Okay? Great. So if Sen's conjecture is correct, then everything below here should be exact. Okay, now, because of the level truncation, Q1, Q0 tilde is not equal to 0. That's because the gauge symmetry of the theory is broken by level truncation. And that means that we cannot really just ask, are these precisely exact states? We have to ask, are they approximately exact? So what we can do is calculate how close each of these states comes to lying in the exact subspace. So we've computed the exact subspace, we compute a basis for that exact subspace, and then we have to choose a sort of ad hoc positive definite norm to see how close each of these states comes to lying in the exact subspace. There are several natural choices. We've tried a number of different obvious things, and they all give basically the same sort of results. So here are the results. So again, this is a calculation of the percent of each state which is in the exact subspace. The blue numbers are the percent. So at level 2, we get this state down here is 97.9% in the exact subspace, and these are decreasing amounts as you go up. The purple states are 99% or more exact. So you see that actually above level 2, all the states below the cutoff are at least 99% exact, and some of them are 99.999% exact. The green states are mostly exact, 70% or more. And the red states are ones which are perhaps physical states, these states which are 50% or more or less exact. So it seems pretty clear from this picture that the states below the cutoff are definitely not inclined to be physical. It looks like actually we do a little bit better than that in the sense that we have to go quite far up, many times above the cutoff, to see states that really look like they're not exact. Okay, now let me address Hiroshi's question. Sorry. So you said, why don't we consider states which are almost closed instead of just states which are actually closed? And let me give you an argument for why we do that. We expect actually to see here continuous families of closed states which are almost exact. These correspond to the fact that for any momentum, you can take a state of ghost number 0, act with Q naught, and you get some state in the image. So you have this infinite, this continuous family of closed states which are also exact. So that corresponds to essentially things which satisfy something like f of x equals 0. if we take a function like f of x equals 0 and we add some noise, so let's, sorry, that's, yeah, if we take some function like that, we take f of x plus eta of x, where eta is some random noise function, then our continuous spectrum of zeros, here's our noise function, is replaced by a randomly spaced discrete spectrum of vanishing points. So by looking at the exactly closed rather than approximately closed states, the states which were exact to begin with are replaced by a discrete spectrum. Each continuous family is replaced by a discrete spectrum of states which are precisely closed but approximately exact. Okay?
I don't understand. So for example, let's consider a scalar field.
Yes.
And then if you find that there is no p, real p squared, that's
yes.
not
Let me say one more thing.
Yeah.
This is what happens to the states which were exact. Now, let me make a similar argument for what happens to the states which were physical.
Right.
Okay, so is there an eraser here somewhere? I'm kind of...
there
we go. Yeah, that's exactly what I want to next address. Okay, so this is what happens for the exact states.
Yeah, that's what I understand.
Good. Okay, so what about the ones which are real? Well, the ones which are real are more like functions f of x equals x minus 1. Okay? That is... there's some sense in which this is more of a topologically stable vanishing point. If we take a function like f of x equals x minus 1, and we add some noise, f of x plus eta of x, which is a small amount of noise, then we still get a function. It may vary slightly, but generically, we still would expect to see f of x prime plus eta of x prime equals 0, for x prime, very close to, but not exactly the same as our original x.
Yeah, counter example is fx is x squared.
That's correct. There are situations where you have very bizarre kinetic terms here where that could happen. I absolutely agree. There are subtle places where this could happen. We can maybe have this discussion offline. I believe that does not happen here. But there is some possibility that there is some stage with very bizarre quadratic terms where this doesn't happen. As a check on this methodology, we did the following thing. We took the original Q operator at the perturbative vacuum, and we perturbed it in a way that broke Q squared equals 0. And then we used exactly the same technique to calculate the cohomology. And there, the physical states stick out like sore thumbs. I mean, they're just clearly there. They all really do correspond to things where you have this fx equals x minus 1. You would have to have a very bizarre form for the quadratic term in order to get something which behaves like x squared at that pole. I agree with you that is technically a possible thing that might happen. So I would use this as evidence and not a proof that there's no physical spectrum. But I think that you would have to have something very bizarre happening for physical poles to be hiding in that way. You know, another thing, let me just say one other thing. We did this calculation by calculating the determinant at various different values of p. And there was some resolution to our spacing. So we calculated for delta p equals 0.0001. Okay? And the closest together we ever found two poles was 0.0039. So we think we found all of them, but it's also possible that there are two poles hiding within much smaller distances than our resolution. I mean, this is really to be interpreted somewhat as an experimental result. I think we can give pretty convincing arguments that nothing should be evading this, but it's not airtight. I'll be the first to agree with that. Okay, so I've kind of already run through my time, so let me not say too much more. I had a few things I was going to say about the massless vector field. So we are in the process of continuing to do this kind of calculation for the other fields like this. This was basically an analysis of the even level scalar fields. We can do similar analyses for the vector fields and tensor fields. We're optimistic that similar answers will come out. One subtlety involves the massless vector field, right? There's a field, an AMU, which seems to be massless in the perturbative theory, and one might imagine that that's protected by gauge symmetry. There's a whole little story I could tell about that, but let me skip that because I'll just summarize. It looks like string field theory does something very special to this massless vector field so that when you get to the bottom of the hill, it actually develops a term that looks like m squared AMU AMU, and therefore it can be treated just like all the other vector fields, all the other massive vector fields. Now, one might argue that gauge invariance protects it from picking up a term like this, but the gauge invariance is only good in a formalism, the usual gauge invariance is only good in a formalism based on something like the Born-Imfeld action, which is only well-defined in the vicinity of the top of the hill. And the coordinate transformation which takes you from this Born-Imfeld action to the string field theory coordinates seems to be singular at the bottom of the hill. I'll just, if I may, skip a couple of transparencies and show you a picture which maybe... let me just skip that because it relates to some other things I might have said. The point is that there's no conflict with gauge invariance if the true vacuum is outside the range of field redefinition. And Sen has a nice picture which sort of makes this clear. If we took two different coordinate systems, an XY coordinate system and an RFI coordinate system, and we had a potential which sort of looked like an upside-down Mexican hat, so we have a circle of stable vacua up here and a stable vacuum at the bottom. If we're right here, phi looks like a good symmetry. It looks like you can generate a zero mode by moving around here. But if you go to the bottom of the hill, it goes away. And in fact, if you took x and y as your coordinates, you'd find that y squared got a mass there. Similar things should be happening with this massless vector field. I don't want to get too much into detail about that. Hopefully we'll have some more concrete results on vector fields using the same kind of spectrum calculation presently. Let me just go here to a summary of some of the things we've shown. So we identified the vacuum to 99.91%. We computed the action up to level 1020 for momentum zero scalars and up to 612 for non-zero momentum scalars. We found that these branch points in the effective potential are gauge artifacts and have now some pictures of what the gauge symmetry looks like, and we're studying that further. And finally, we've given evidence that the open string states are removed from the spectrum in level truncation in accord with Sen's conjecture. And I think there's lots of interesting questions that one can still ask about this, and in some sense, I think we've really only scratched the surface of this rather interesting problem. So I'll stop there. This is not related to, B mu nu in the closed string spectrum, which has a mass squared which vanishes. This is a massive field. This is a massless field. They have the same letter, but they're totally different. Now, it is a big question whether any of the closed string fields appear in any natural way at the bottom of the hill. And that's really something which we're going to probably have to go to the quantum theory to really begin to address. Fascinating question, but I don't have more to say about it. Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
How difficult would it be to turn on a constant electric field or something like that in this scheme?
It's actually remarkably difficult, and let me tell you why. Okay, if you just have a regular gauge theory, you could just turn on a constant field. Let me actually talk about a constant magnetic field, although an electric field would be exactly the same. It's just we don't get into problems with the zero Lorentz indices. Imagine we wanted to turn on a Bij equals zero, where this is the magnetic field. Let me not even write Bij, because there's too many Bs floating around. We want to write down something where Dij minus Djai is not equal to zero. It's equal to some constant, let's say. Now, in the coordinates where we have either a Born-Imfeld or a Yang-Mills action, this is the natural thing to do, and we could write down something like Ai. Let's just say we could write A2 equals lambda times X1, right? That would be a perfectly fine thing to do. We could write down a configuration like that. Now, if we try to do that in string field theory, it's much more complicated. And the reason is related to this field redefinition I mentioned, which takes us from Born-Imfeld variables to string field theory variables, and which breaks down at the bottom of the hill. There's an AMU in string field theory, but it is not the same as A mu in Born-Imfeld or Yang-Mills theory. They are the same for small deformations, but when we turn on a lot of A mu, we have to do something more. Let me give you a concrete way of understanding that. If we compactify on a circle, we can turn on a constant A mu with no problem at all in Born-Imfeld or Yang-Mills theory. It's just a zero mode of the theory. This is actually part of what I was going to say, but I didn't get to. We can turn on a zero mode of A mu. What happens if we try to turn on a zero mode of A mu in string field theory? Well, there are coupling terms. There are terms which look like a mu phi in string field theory. And, of course, there are also phi squared terms. What this means is that if we turn on a mu, all the other fields also start getting turned on. So we get, for instance, phi goes as a mu, plus, et cetera. So, in fact, if we fix a mu and try to solve for all the other fields, we find that all the other fields get turned on.
Is this in some particular case?
No. It's either, okay, the easiest way to do it is in Feynman-Siegel gauge. But even if you do it in no particular gauge, if you do level truncation, you would see the same thing. Of course, if you don't fix gauge or do level truncation, then there's a continuous gauge family of things.
There is some ambiguity because for constant mu locally, the gauge field is trivial.
Right. Sorry, where's the ambiguity? I mean, if we fix Feynman-Siegel, let's just fix Feynman-Siegel gauge and do it in that gauge, if that's okay. Maybe we can discuss later what in the sense it makes to do this without fixing gauge. I mean, there are definitely subtleties which have to be dealt with if we don't fix gauge and try to do this calculation. If we're on S1, then a mu is not pure gauge globally if we turn on something. Yeah, so let's restrict attention to compactifying on S1 and turning on a constant a mu, which is really a physical deformation and therefore is not gauge equivalent to zero. Anyway, we get this non-zero effect on all the other fields. So, for instance, there's a very nice description of this by Ashok Sen and Barton Zwieback, where they try to find flat directions in the theory. They try to turn on a mu. And what they find is, if they start at the perturbative vacuum and they turn on a mu, they get an effective potential for a mu which goes up slightly and hits a branch point. And if they raise the level, this is in level truncation, if they raise the level of truncation, they get a family of curves which always go up just a little bit. It looks like they approach a flat curve in the limit where level truncation is removed, but there's a singularity there. What that means is that you cannot write down the string field theory description of more than a finite value of a mu. If you try to go past that, you hit some kind of a problem which you can't get at through level truncation. It may be related to the fact that the field configuration which you get to here becomes non-normalizable, in that all the other fields, all the massive fields, get more and more turned on as you go to higher and higher mass levels. So this is sort of a long-winded way of saying that we can't turn on an arbitrarily large gauge field, an arbitrarily large constant gauge field, and because we can't turn on an arbitrarily large constant gauge field, we certainly can't write down something which looks like A2 equals lambda X1, because as X1 becomes large, we hit that branch point, and we don't know how to go past that. So actually, I would love to be able to write down a constant magnetic field or electric field, because you would be able to address a lot of really interesting questions with it. But there seems to be this rather tricky problem associated with doing that. Yeah?
Yeah, I'd like to ask again, what happens to the gauge invariance in the bottom of the potential?
Okay, there is still gauge invariance. This term here?
Yeah.
I believe, although we haven't completely shown it yet, that delta, I mean, remember, the gauge invariance, this is a couple of things I skipped, so let me just put up a transparency here. Yeah, the point is that the gauge invariance in string theory is not the same as the gauge invariance in, here we go. This is what the string field theory action looks like, the thing on the top. This is invariant under gauge transformations where delta a mu is d mu lambda.
Is this a billion or none of them?
This is even just a billion.
Well, for a billion, you can write down this. I mean, this is just a Fukuberg.
Right, you get the same thing in a non. It's the same. You get a similar thing in a non-abelian one, though.
Between a billion and non-abelian.
Well, you get the same thing in a non-abelian theory.
Okay.
I mean, you get the same kinds of terms. The point is that you have a d mu.
Write down the other term too. You
right.
Also want the derivative term for to the variation of mu.
Right. The important thing here, though, is that d phi is also changing under a mu. So the reason this is relevant is because if you're at the bottom of the hill, I mean, there are terms in the action which have things like phi a mu, right? Mm-hmm. And so when you look at d a mu, you get things like this is equal to phi. Sorry, this is equal to d mu lambda plus things like phi lambda. or phi d mu lambda. So if phi takes an expectation value, it actually changes what d mu lambda, d mu a mu become, the change in a mu becomes. So I believe the correct answer is that this d mu, this d of a mu, the gauge variation of this, becomes some function of the fields d mu lambda. And in fact, when you get phi equals phi critical, in other words, if you're at the bottom of the hill, this thing goes to zero. And I believe that that's, that solution will describe things both in the abelian and non-abelian theory. I believe that's going to be the answer, but I haven't finished calculating that. So,
okay.
So I think it's, I think it really is due to the fact that this breakdown of the Born-Infeld or Yang-Mills description occurs at the bottom of the hill. So the gauge transformation, which looks fine down to the bottom of the hill, ceases to be, you know, there's some singularity in the coordinate transformation there. Yeah, Emil?
Suppose we track, say, the tachyon or any of your favorite physical field.
Yep.
Turn on the expectation value.
This is a very good question, but you have to be careful about what you mean by tracking it, right? Now you have to be able to describe the theory when you're halfway down the hill, which is not in a vacuum.
But you've got a Lagrangian. My question is,
yeah,
if we look at the linearized spectrum,
yep,
okay, there's some particle, you start off with the top of the hill,
yep,
and some particular physical mass square.
Yep.
Okay. And by the time you get to the bottom of the pole, bottom of the hill, that pole has either moved off somewhere in the complex plane or something.
Yep.
How does it...
Yeah, we're actually doing that calculation, but I don't... You have to, it's a little tricky to do that. Because you're trying to look at the spectrum of a theory where you've got a tadpole and stuff. But I think you can be sensible about it and do it. I don't know the answer, but I think it moves off to infinity. It's a good question. Yeah?
The open string vacuum seems to be accommodated by the cubic field theory for the open strings, at least to test the sense conjecture.
Yes.
But suppose at the end of the day, this will work fine, and the open string vacuum will decay to the closed string plus the D25 vein.
Yes.
But we still have closed string, closed bosonic closed string theory with its own tachyon. So what happens? What does it feed that in this picture?
Okay. If we could ever use this picture to address anything regarding the fate of the closed string tachyon, I would say that would be a big success for open string field theory. At this point, we can't even see the closed string tachyon. If we can eventually get to the point where we can see it, then we might be able to address that question, because it is a well-defined theory. I mean, as you know, the closed string field theory is a really complicated Baroque object where you have to add stuff at every order, and it's difficult to really imagine doing concrete calculations in that theory. In this theory, if we could ever see the closed string tachyon, we might have some hope of doing calculations. We might have to go to the quantum version of the theory, though, which might have some problems. So, I don't know.
So to make sense of the closed string theory, tachyons, we won't be able to do it for in the same way as for the open bosonic strings, because one of the things in the early 90s is it doesn't make sense, or a closed string field theory does not make sense.
People have made a lot of interesting speculations, most of which I don't understand, and some of which involve things like saying that you can get superstrings out of bosonic string theory and things like that. I think it is a good chance that we'll find out that the bosonic string really isn't a well-defined closed string theory. And at that point, we have to go and start working on the superstring. But it's also possible that it'll tie in some unexpected way to the other theories we know and love. So,
is it one of the things it's sometimes hard to follow, especially for someone who get involved into the field in the last 5 years. So, well, we read all the papers that at some point the open string field theory was abandoned because of all the troubles it had, and somehow there was papers by some people that the closed string field theory also made the idea of writing closed string theory maybe doesn't make sense at all from a physical point of view due to some...
Yep.
Non-perturbative. One of the obstacles I remember was the behavior one of a G.
Yep. There are certainly some very good and
what's the new
possibly
all that knowledge. Where does it fit me nowadays?
I would say nobody's working hard on the closed string field theory. My own one which is sort of a fantasy. My one fantasy about this is that somehow when we get to the bottom of the hill, we have this open string field theory, that somehow that will secretly be encoding a closed string field theory. I don't know whether that's true or not, but it could be a totally different description of the closed string field theory, where the closed strings emerge as some kind of confined objects and, it would be a well-defined theory which was very different from anything anybody's ever tried to write down for closed string field theory. I don't know why it would be right, except that Sen's conjecture seems to push us in that direction.
How are these brains incorporated in this theory?
Well, we see that we have a D25 brain. In fact, Emma will tell you more about that this afternoon. Yeah.
I would like to ask you a question.
Sure.
Well, all these calculations, of course, make the assumptions that our concept of the continuum, in the sense of Cantor Aleph 1, still holds at the very extremely small Planck length. Now, what can there's absolutely no evidence that that is true. Now, if, of course, if you would replace it by a non-Archimedean metric or non-Archimedean structure at the Planck length,
yes,
then Lorentz invariance cannot be exactly correct. It will, can then still be understood as a dynamic symmetry. Now, if you throw out Lorentz invariance, would be only an asymptotic symmetry, then you don't get this crazy idea with the tachyons. I mean, the tachyon thing doesn't make sense. That would be simply cannot occur.
You don't like,
I mean, there's no evidence whatsoever, experimental evidence, that tachyons exist. Okay?
Well, the tachyon's gone by the time we get to the bottom of the hill. But let me make two comments.
The whole tachyon thing is an artifact.
Wait, can I make two comments?
Yeah, okay, go ahead.
One comment is that, in some sense, this thing I was mentioning here, where we try to turn on an A mu, and it means that actually we cannot go in an arbitrary distance. This is related to the fact that space-time is perhaps not so well-defined as it looks in this picture.
So with all the time, use integration, differentiation, that is all continuums, a continuum hypothesis.
Let me...
So you must make some more assumptions. In other words, Einstein introduced geometry part of physics.
Right.
Maybe number theory must be made part of physics here at the Planck legs. And that, I think, is not taken seriously by the scientific community who is doing this kind of stuff. Lots of people are very skeptical. I come here as a critic to these
things.
Because I would like to know what is their physics on it. What kind of physics?
Let me make two brief comments.
Okay,
one comment is that if we, instead of considering a D25 brain, we consider a D0 brain, then essentially we get something which...
A point-like
object.
Okay,
then those points actually do not live in a continuous space-time. In some sense, they live in a space-time defined by some kind of non-commuting objects. And in fact, these X mu's, which are the positions of those points, are precisely these things I was saying we couldn't really define very well at arbitrary distances. So I don't want to get too much into this, but I think there's a sense in which the space-time structure is much more subtle in this theory than you might imagine.
The physicist.
Yes.
Points, lines, surfaces are abstract elements of Euclidean geometry.
Yep.
Which have no place in the theory of physics, because what is zero or infinite, you cannot measure.
Okay.
Okay. I mean, how can you defend that? I mean, a lot of physicists are very skeptical about this kind of stuff.
I would just say that in this formalism, these are no longer really points. They start out as points, but they aren't anymore.
Yeah, what is
the second comment is that, actually, one of the people who worked on this a lot, Kostolesky.
A point has a measure zero. What is it then if it's not a point? Can you tell me mathematically what it is if it's not a point?
No, because we don't understand string field theory well enough yet.
Excuse me.
I'll stop there.
Out of time. Maybe we should...
Maybe we can take that one off. I'll be happy to talk in the break.
Okay.